So there's my screen. So this was nice. So how many Seahawks fans? I know people in the real world can't raise their hand. I saw this today. There's no sound. The sound's not profane or anything. It's kind of funny. If you search on YouTube, I'm sure you can see it. Effectively, a guy reacting to the play call, right? The infamous play call. So he's complaining right now. There's no profanity. So it's safe for work if you want to go find it on YouTube. And there he goes, right? Effectively, the video is called The Worst Reaction Ever, right? There goes his old TV. Granted, he needed a new TV anyway. That was like a rear projection TV from, what, 10 years ago, but whatever. Okay, enough making fun of our wonderful friends in Seattle and Redmond.
Where'd you get that video be from?
Of you? So, Wally, did you actually have a reaction like that, Wally?
No,
I didn't think so. There you go. I think you were the only one in the room, though, right? I mean, there's probably a few Cowboys fans in here. Is that a true story? Where'd the one go? Where'd Eric go? He's over there. No, it's not. It was Blake. That's right. Blake's the Cowboys fan. So I was amazed that there actually was one here in Dallas. But anyway, so I actually don't have my Twitter handle up here. You know, if you've watched any of Johan's sessions, and the one thing I always tell my customers, they're like, how do you keep up with these things? And the thing that Johan says is Twitter, Twitter, Twitter. So my handle's real easy. Just put an @ in front of my name, take away the space, and you've got my Twitter handle. It's a great way to keep up with the world of Config Manager, the world of IT in general. It's definitely an overload, so be ready to filter. But at the same time, you're never going to find everything on all the web that is actually out there, and that's why you have other people, your wonderful friends on Twitter, that help you do those kind of things. So, all right, so security with Config Manager. So this is a great way to start it out, right? This is actually a little bit of an older thing that Microsoft posted a while back. Effectively, the 10 immutable laws of security, right? These things haven't changed. It's interesting. This is, like I said, I don't remember when they posted this. This might be upwards of 10 years ago when they actually came up with these laws. But these are laws that you really, they hold true. And if you're not thinking about these laws when you're going out through your day-to-day business, then you're probably going to miss something. So how many of you all are IT admins in here, day-to-day admins? I think everybody. I don't know about all the folks online. So those same people, how many of you is it your real job to do security? So anyone who didn't just raise their hand, you're wrong. You really are wrong. If you take anything away from what happened over Christmas, everyone knows what happened over Christmas, right? The Sony attacks. If you take anything away from that, right, security is everyone's job. Particularly when you're in IT, you have to think about these things in everything you do. Otherwise, you're going to leave yourself and your organization vulnerable. Heck, even at home. How much data is on your computer at home that you don't want the bad guys to get? Right? So you've got to be thinking about it just at home, right? So are you using the Wi-Fi router from your cable company? Right? I actually looked at mine. I don't buy Wi-Fi from my cable company. I rent the modem just because I do. But I have my own router, my own firewall, my own Wi-Fi hotspot. You know, of course, it's all in one. But I went down to my router the other day, and I looked, and all of a sudden, Wi-Fi was on. I'm like, that's not necessarily a good thing. I'm glad I'm not using that network. Because when I first got it, I remember going in and looking. Wi-Fi was not enabled. But now it is enabled. So most of the cable companies, they're going to start reselling your bandwidth. There's some things, I'm sure you guys have seen some of that talk recently. I don't like that necessarily, but it was grayed out. I couldn't disable it. So I have yet to call them. This was just like last week that I discovered it. But at the end of the day, it could be a way someone could get onto my network, right? Now, granted, I don't have any special access to my customers necessarily. I don't have special access to anything at Catapult. But let's say I'm a CIO, I'm a CEO. I probably do. And that's an easy way for hackers to come in. They don't have to go through my corporate security necessarily. They can come to my home. They can hop onto my Wi-Fi hotspot and ride my VPN in, right? They don't have to get through all the elaborate security that may or may not be there at my corporate location. They can just piggyback in off of my home because my home is not secure at all. They can sit, you know, right outside, depending upon where exactly you live, right? And they can get access to those kind of things. So you need to think about this in everything you do. It does not stop with the security guys. So the laws, you probably have all read through them. I won't go through any of them really explicitly, except for the highlighted ones. So the first one, it's a big thing. Right? If you think back 10 years ago, 15 years ago, how many of y'all were in IT 15 years ago? There's a few of you. Good. At least there's a couple of you, I think, that have been in IT longer than I have. So that doesn't make me feel too old. Thank you, Steve. But we're obviously getting up there in age. I am. I've been around for a little while. Hackers, what did they want to do 15 years ago, 10 years ago? They just wanted to do bad things. They were malicious. They wanted to get their name up on their little lists and their boards and things like that. They wanted to cause havoc. What are hackers doing today? Right, think about it. What did they do for Sony, right? Nobody really knows all the details of Sony yet, but there were lots of theories thrown around out there. What did they do in Target's case? They were stealing, right? They were there for theft and profit. They weren't there really to cause Target harm, although at the end of the day, of course, they did. They were there to make money. They were just doing the common thievery type thing that was out there. It's exactly what Sony was ultimately about, right? They were stealing, they were in it for profits. Now, Russian mob would be the perfect example. That's the example I throw around out a lot. If you've read any of Mark Rusinovich's books, it's one of the common themes that he plays on. This is the Russian mob. These are other folks that are in it for the money. They are actually a criminal enterprise doing these kind of things. Now, you also have, of course, who's the other culprits in the Sony hack? Right? Anybody? Anybody follow? Korea, right? North Korea, right? Our wonderful friends in North Korea, as the case may or may not be. They're in it, obviously, for national pride, national, you know, hacking actually causing damage to the U.S. in general, which is probably why they weren't so much involved in that one, but that's a whole other topic, right? But the point is that these are actually organized folks. It's not just that script kiddie. It's not just that single individual that we have to be afraid of now. We have to be afraid of actual organizations that are well organized, that have money, that have the will and resources to get through any obstacle that's put in their way to get what they want, right? They're not just going to necessarily move on to that next target. And so really, that's really where the first one comes down to it, right? Social engineering is the huge one. The Sony hack attack was a piece of that. The Target, if you've read about Target, Target was all social engineering. They didn't actually crack Target's security. They cracked a vendor's security through social engineering and got in through that vendor's VPN into Target's network. Once they got into that network, it was game over, right? Because they were able to start running the programs on the POS systems. They started running something inside that security barrier, and now it was game over. They had everything they wanted. Same with number two, right? If I can alter your operating system, it's game over. That one's usually not as big of a deal anymore. Once again, the hackers aren't out there to damage you. That's what typically injecting a DLL, something like that, is going to do. It's going to corrupt your OS. They don't really care about that much anymore. If they can do that and inject code to steal things, though, that's really what they're after. So most of the other ones don't necessarily apply to infrastructure, but they're all good ones to know about. So obviously top 10, so here's the rest of that list, a couple more that are highlighted. The first one up on there, number 6, is interesting. How many of you trust your users with corporate security and corporate secrets? Nobody, right? So how many of you, so the following question really, how many of you give your users local admin permissions? And hopefully no one raises their hand in here. I still walk into customers who do this. I still answer questions on the forums where people want to know how to give their users local admin privileges. And it is such a contradiction when you look at number 6, right? Because you can ask them this question, the question I asked first. Do you trust your users with this? Unequivocally, everyone should say no, absolutely not, right? If that's the true statement, then there is no way that number 6 should ever happen in an enterprise. So that one's easy. I think that one, everyone sees that one. Sometimes it's hard to really get that one done. There's always politics involved. We all love politics. The other one, the out-of-date anti-malware, I think that one's been driven into our heads, right? Everyone, it's one of the first things that most techs are going to check. Most security guys, it's the first thing they're going to do. But it is something that on occasion gets forgotten, right? Just because you deployed antivirus out there doesn't mean squat, right? In reality, if you're not checking up on it, it's a false sense of security, right? If you have definitions that are a month old, 2 months old, however old, just because the virus scanner's running doesn't mean you're actually protected at that point. And it's actually a false sense of security. Okay, I said the security word a lot. Here's the dictionary definition of what it is. One key word that I highlighted in here, it's all about resistance, right? So this is similar to, do we all remember the club? I don't know if they had the club in Europe. The club was something you put on the steering wheel so that the steering wheel couldn't turn, right? So the thieves could get in, they could start the car, but they couldn't turn the steering wheel. So if you've ever seen a professional thief break into a car with a club, with the razor wire, go through the club in less than 10 seconds, you'll know that the club ultimately was pretty useless for someone who really wanted that car. However, if a thief comes up and wants a car, doesn't really matter which one, and he looks in the window and he sees the club on one car and not on the other car, why is he going to waste even that 10 seconds on the car that has the club? He's not, right? They're smart. They're not dumb people necessarily. They just don't want, they're lazy in general. You know, a whole nother side conversation. So that's what it's all about. We want to put obstacles in the path of the bad guys to make sure that they don't have an easy way to get to our data, to get to our assets, to compromise our enterprise. Another key piece that's in here is it's really a measure. There is no way you can say, I am secure. It is not an absolute in any way. It is a variable scale. It is a subjective scale depending upon what you're protecting, where you're protecting it, the complete value of those things that you're protecting. And it's going to be different for each and every organization. If I'm a bank, I'm going to have a totally different standard than if I'm a mom-and-pop grocery store. Doesn't mean the mom-and-pop grocery store doesn't need security. There's still things that they need to protect. But they don't have nearly as much of it, and the penalties and the costs of them being compromised aren't nearly as big, right? That's all pretty obvious. But we just don't think about it sometimes. Sometimes we just think of security as this absolute, and it absolutely is not that. So when we talk about enterprise security, there's really three pillars that we can start thinking about when we're looking at all the things in our environment. So confidentiality, right? We want to make sure that things that are secret are kept secret, or things that we don't want the world or the public to know about. In our personal lives, our bank accounts, our social security numbers for us as Americans. As a corporation, salaries, things like that. For celebrities, selfies, right? We don't want those things to actually get out there. There's lots of those things. We want to make sure that those are things that no one else gets. Integrity. We want to make sure that data doesn't get tampered with or really altered. So if I have a bank account number and someone alters that bank account number, what good is that bank account number anymore? So any piece of data you can say that for, right? If it gets altered so the bad guys can get to it, do something to it, they don't actually have to steal it. But if now they've corrupted it in some way, that's probably going to cause me harm, right? So if I'm a chemical company and I come up with some fantastic new chemical, right, that cures whatever, cancer, and someone breaks in and changes that formula, the formula is not only not good for me anymore, it's probably going to start killing people, right? So that's obviously a very dire, extreme example, but it's an easy example to see, and it's going to happen in anything that you have in your environment. And the last one's availability. If I have something but I can't get to it, I don't really have it anymore, right? Kind of contradicted myself there. If I can't get to it, wherever it may be, it's not really mine anymore, and it's not actually providing any value to me anymore. Right, so I've got to make sure that all of these things are in place. So this goes for data as well as assets. In general, in IT, we're talking about the data, our users' data, the corporation's data, at home, our personal data, our photos, those kind of things. But it goes for the assets too in general, right, the computer systems themselves. It goes back to those 10 laws. So one of those laws on there, right, if someone physically has my box, it's not my box anymore, right? It doesn't matter what kind of passwords or what kind of encryption's on that box. They're going to find a way in. So most of the time we're talking data, but you need to consider both of those aspects. So how do we get there, right? So this is a castle in Ghent, Belgium. Kim Opelfens took my wife and I there in September. And it's a perfect metaphor of what we want to do with security. It's the layers. So sometimes you see the layers of an onion for security. Castle's another perfect example. We have the moat. We have the drawbridge. We have the gates, we have the portcullises, we have all the wonderful things that come with a medieval castle. It's not perfect though, right? Castles weren't impenetrable. There's a handful you can find over in Europe that, you know, were never overrun. But that was just because technology didn't catch up to them. And although really technology did catch up to them, and that's why they abandoned them, right? They weren't there anymore. So Kim actually told us a story, and you can go look it up, and I can't say the name, there's a festival now. But in 1949, a group of students were protesting the price hike for beer, right? So if you've ever been to Belgium, they love their beer, right? So if Kenny, if you're watching, you're the prime example of this. And so they didn't like that all of a sudden beer was more expensive. So they took over this castle and they defended it with tomatoes. They kept it, I don't remember how long Kim said, like I said, it's all out there somewhere. They actually kept hold of the castle for like 2 days. You know, the police didn't storm it, they didn't put any huge effort on it, but anytime anyone tried to come and get them out, they just used tomatoes. Why? Because everything was already in place, right? The gates were already in place, the walls were already in place, they could close the drawbridge because there actually is a moat around this castle, and they were able to defend that. So that's kind of one of the other morals here. Or really one of the other paths here is you guys don't have to invent anything to be secure necessarily, to get down that security path. The tools are all in place. The guidance is all in place out there. You just have to take the time to sit down and learn it and follow it. So going back to the question of how many of you are actually doing security or think security is part of your job every day, right? It is. You just got to figure out where it fits in and how to apply the principles that other folks have actually put out there for you. So really, that's Config Manager, right? How does it fit in? So anyone would consider Config Manager a straight-up security tool? No, right? It really isn't. But that's just because they don't bill it as a security tool. Once again, going back to our key word and our definition before, resistance. How can we add resistance to what the bad guys are trying to do using Config Manager, right? That's the question we're asking here. So there's stuff that's built in, obviously. But what other things can we use outside of Config Manager? So within Config Manager, obviously, we have SCEP. How many of y'all are using SCEP within the room? A handful of you? Okay, as long as you're using an antivirus at this point in time, it's pretty good. Although, honestly, if you start looking at some of the statistics out there, even Symantec is saying that only about 20 to 30% of the threats in the real world today can be mitigated via antivirus. So kind of going back to our 10 immutable laws, right? It's just one law and they're having the antivirus. There's a lot of other things that you need to start thinking about. What are those other things? Well, that's where other smart people come in. This is just one example. There's lots of other examples out there of guidance to follow. So this is the Australian Signals Directorate. And they actually put out a nice little guide. And I think I have it pulled up. It's available in a PDF form also. And they literally go down and will count, I don't remember the number offhand, I'm not sure if I ever actually looked. They have 35 different safeguards that you can do in an enterprise, in an IT environment, to actually protect your assets and to protect your data. They also have them categorized, sorry for a little bit of scrolling there, and I'm not going to make you read it, more or less just showing you what's there, but they have them categorized into security effectiveness. And there are top four in here. They're all classified as essential. I'll talk about each of these a little bit more in a second. But if you go to the top of this page, if I don't launch OneNote, if I go to this top of this page, I think they have it on here. It might be on another page. But if you implement these top four things, now granted, this is, you know, statistics are wonderful made-up numbers, right? But they say that 85% of all things in threats, vulnerabilities, et cetera, in an environment can be mitigated by just implementing the top four things on this list. So definitely, you know, go download this, peruse through it. Make sure that you understand how each one of these can affect your job and how you can implement them to make your environment more secure. And this resolution, there we go. So what are those top four things? Let me go back to my presentation. There we go. So these are the what's essential type things. Number one, application whitelisting. Everyone knows they have application whitelisting built into Windows, correct? Anyone that doesn't know that? I always ask questions in the wrong way. So anyone that doesn't know it, good. So this is called AppLocker. You do need an EA because you do need Windows Enterprise at this point in time. So some people may not actually have it licensed, but it's a huge benefit. There's one downside of AppLocker. Anyone know what that one downside is right now? Anybody? Okay, I'll answer that one. Pretty easy softball one there. If you don't have Active Directory joined computers, or if you don't trust group policy, a lot of organizations simply don't trust group policy, or it's very laborious for them to get group policies implemented in their environment, right, without a lot of paperwork, red tape, et cetera. So how do I implement that? What's the greatest answer that's come up in IT, or at least in the Microsoft world in the last 2 years? It's another softball answer. Chad, you got to know this one. Configuration baselines. No, and just IT, Microsoft IT. Come on, Chad. It's Garth's favorite thing. PowerShell, right? Everything's accessible via PowerShell now, right? So I'm actually going to demo how we can apply application whitelisting via AppLocker using PowerShell and Config Manager, right? We want to do it centrally. So that's kind of the cool thing about group policy. If you're actually using group policy to its utmost and all your machines are domain joined, right, is that you don't have to worry about it. It's centrally managed, but now you can't report on it. You lose some of that. So if we move that functionality into Config Manager using PowerShell, then we've gained all those things. So I'll demo that in a second. Application patching. Hopefully you guys have talked to some of the vendors. There was a session just before mine upstairs. How many of y'all went to that one? Right. So there's some great statistics to that company will put out there about that 85% number keeps coming up. I think that's one of the numbers they throw out there, right? That 85% of the attack surface within Windows is non-Microsoft, right? It's actually applications. And so that's another one of those huge ones. That's why it's an essential one. You can't just do the OS. You have to do that also. iOS patching, right? So Kent hit on this one in his session there. If you're not doing OS patching, then you've really kind of neglected one of those essential things. So is there anyone in here that's not doing it? I don't think I'd expect anyone to actually raise their hand, right? That would be kind of folly. Yay, I'm not doing those kind of things. I don't lock my doors at night, right? I live downtown and I don't lock my doors. It's kind of that thing. So, and the last one, you know, I talked about that one already. That was the 10 immutable laws, right? That was effectively number one. Or actually, it was number six, right? So on to the demo. Application whitelisting. So this one's actually quite easy if I don't click on PowerPoint again. So we're going to hop over to one of my boxes. So I don't know how many of you all have seen application whitelisting before. So this is my Windows 8.1 box. And I don't want Chrome to win or run. So I don't think I actually have Zoom in on this box. I have it on the other ones. But you all can see that nice little message that comes up. It says, nope, your administrator has blocked Google Chrome. Right, we don't want Google Chrome on this box. So there's lots of different things that you can do, and there's lots of different ways. I'm not going to delve into AppLocker because that's a whole session in and of itself. But at this point, if your organization didn't trust Google Chrome or whatever else they don't trust, right, we can block via policy. And as long as the user's not a local admin, so going back to that, there's no way for them to get around this. If they're a local admin, right, all bets are off. They can do whatever they want to do. So if we go over here to my Windows 7 box, and the resolution is going to throw me off, isn't it? That's okay. Basically, I go to my local security policy. And here I do have a slow zoom it. So notice here we have my application control policies. Right, my executable rules, my Windows installer rules, and my script rules. Windows 8.1 actually introduces a fourth one. I don't remember what it is offhand, but there is a fourth one that gets introduced in here. So there's some extra that you can actually do. In this case, we're looking at my executable rules, and you can see my top rule right there. Right, and this is from my local policy. I'm not doing this in my domain policy. I'm not doing this, something that's going to go across my environment. Initially, I'm just going to configure it on one single box. So in this case, let's block Chrome. Now, the cool thing about these whitelist rules is that by default, we can set up these default rules that I have here. Let me zoom back in real quick. And they allow everything that's built into Windows, right? Because it would be bad if we blocked like explorer.exe or any of the other core basic DLLs or any of those kind of things. So these core rules just say, okay, everything that we know is good in Windows, go ahead and let them run. Now, you can block those if for some reason you don't want people to run Notepad, right? You can absolutely block those. Or if you have an alternate shell, like on a kiosk, you can absolutely block those now, right? So there's a valid reason to potentially block Explorer. But you don't have to if you don't want to do those things. Think through all of that. They've already thought of that piece for you. So it's really, really easy in PowerShell. You can actually already see. I will CLS that and move up to the top with my multiple scroll bars. It's literally a one-line command to pull that out of my local policy, right? This is pretty well documented on TechNet, so not anything difficult. Get AppLocker policy, the dash local for my local, and I want to dump it to an XML file. Super easy to do. There we go. I just dumped it to the desktop. Now, I have a helper function in here. That was the helper function that I don't want to show. You can go find it, because this dumps it out into a file that's all contiguous. If you ever looked at XML without any spacing in there, kind of hard to read. So that's all this this helper function, this format XML, is going to do. And it's going to dump it into a Notepad file so that we can actually read it. So let me go ahead and zoom in on that one. Notice we have my three sections. If I did this off of Windows 8.1, we'd have the fourth one in there. Three sections, it put our ID in there, right? Our nice little ID. So we don't have to create any of these things. And all those other things that I put in the GUI, so you don't have to figure out what this format actually means. If you want to come in here and edit it and figure out what all these things mean, absolutely, you can do those kind of things. And then you can import it in, and I'll show you that part in a second also. But you can just actually put it in a GUI, right? GUI is always a little bit easier to do things initially when you don't know all these interesting incantations. It's all in there, and now I can take that and run that via Config Manager. So let's hop over to Config Manager, and we'll go, I'm using our packages, software library, packages, and here I have AppLocker policy. It contains effectively just that XML file as in the package source itself. Here's my program. And if we scroll to the end, notice I'm running PowerShell there. I'll zoom in a second. All right, I'm just running execution policy bypass. Okay, keep going. There we go, set app locker policy. And that's it. All I did was give it that XML file that I just spit out. So let me zoom in on that real quick. Super easy to do. Nothing special, right, through the GUI. Honestly, it would take me maybe 2 minutes to go through and test to configure those kind of things, maybe a little bit more. It just depends upon all the things that you're going to want to explicitly block in your environment, which could be a lot of things, right? And now we have just a simple XML. There's also a merge switch for this commandlet. So I could actually have multiple policies that ultimately get merged together. So now I could go through and have different collections that have different users in them and have all of these policies merged together at the end of the day, right? And now I have my application whitelisting via AppLocker. Now, the example I gave wasn't really application whitelisting, right? It was application blacklisting. But you can absolutely go through in AppLocker and say, only these things are good, right? Because when we talk about whitelisting and blacklisting, it's the same problem with antivirus, right? A whitelist is things we know are good. So those are pretty well defined. All the Windows things are good. Blacklist is all the things that we know are bad. But there's an in-between, right? There really is a gray list, if you will, of things we just don't know about. So if we're using whitelisting, we don't care about gray list and blacklist. Those things can grow bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Our whitelist is always going to be a finite set. If we're worried about that blacklist, our gray list could get bigger and bigger, and now we have an issue. And that's really one of the problems with antivirus today, is there's that gray middle that we just don't know about and really changes on a daily, if not hourly, basis, right? Because the real world is just that bad now. The wonderful big old battled internet is out there. So pretty easy to do, right? We don't have to worry about our domain joins anymore. We don't have to worry about having group policy actually working all through the power of PowerShell. So anyone not written any PowerShell code in here at all? See, that's another one of those loaded questions, so that's good that you all kept your hands down. What's PowerShell? Was that you, Steve? Okay, so the next one, a little bit about local admins. Let me see here. There's another slide in here real quick. Let me show that one. So first thing, auditing is definitely part of security, right? You kind of want to know what's going on in your environment. If you don't know what's going on, how are you going to prevent things from actually happening? So Sherry's had a blog post out there for a long time about how to extend your MOF file, how to go and collect this information. I'm not really going to hash that. But that's an easy one to do. It's going to help you report on those things and then actually mitigate those things. But the mitigation part is the part that you can't take care of by simple inventory. So I had these requirements from a specific customer. It wasn't just this small subset of users was always an admin, right? That's just not realistic in a real enterprise. You're always going to have these different cases across your enterprise. This set of systems gets this groups and these users, et cetera, right? It's going to be something a little more convoluted. And so that's really what this slide is summarizing. Definitely a bunch of things. So once again, Config Manager, while it's not really doing the security work, it is doing the legwork of configuring that all for us. So if we go in and we look at my baselines, there we go. And I have a configuration item in here. local admin remediation. So this is actually a real-world example that I did up for a customer that implemented that exact slide or the exact requirements that were on that slide. We go over to my settings. We do an edit. So another loaded question, how many of you are not using baselines, right? Yeah, there's Cameron in the back, of course. I won't look at these scripts in here because they will be painfully difficult to look at. I will post these scripts on my blog. I'll give you a quick preview of them just to show you that they actually exist. And I keep moving over there to the wrong side. But basically, we can implement anything we want. This is PowerShell again. So going back to that, if you haven't learned PowerShell, this makes life a lot easier. But now we can go through and we can have our discovery script. So let's go discover where those things are at. And then let's actually have the remediation script. So I wrote these scripts. They have full logging involved. They drop logs onto the local system. And of course, they're just a configuration manager baseline that gets run on every one of our systems, regardless of domain join status, right? Regardless of VPN status. We don't care about that anymore, which group policies can sometimes have issues with, right? Regardless of group policy being broken, which we've all hopefully not seen a whole lot of, but I've definitely seen it in environments, right? So we want to get away from using our authentication mechanism, our directory, for enforcing policies. And that's exactly what Configuration Manager is giving us. Lots of flexibility, definitely a little bit of elbow grease involved, right? You have to know how to do some of these things behind the scenes. Okay. So this one's particularly for Kent. So these are the good things, or what the excellent things on that Australian Signals Directorate list. There's more than just that's on there, right? Some of these don't really apply to infrastructure, so I culled them out, or they really can't be done through Configuration Manager for whatever reason. So the two things on here are OS exploit mitigation. So that's kind of an interesting phrase. We'll look at that one in a little more in depth in a second. But then we have host-based firewalls. So another one of those loaded questions. How many of you don't have the Windows firewall or another firewall enabled on your workstations and your servers, right? So that's obviously a leading question, and Cameron keeps raising his hand. So to the Russian mob out there, you go hack Cameron, because he's got all the good stuff. Yeah, so I ask this question of customers all the time, right? And I walk in, so are you going to do Windows-based firewalls when we do images? Oh no, you know, we don't know what all of our users are doing. What? Do you realize what you just said? You don't know what's hosted on your users' computers, so you're afraid you're going to break something. That's just a terrible statement that you don't actually know what's going on in your environment. And that is exactly contradictory to what's going on in security. Right? It's like that castle metaphor, right? It's the security guard that got paid off in the back and is opening the back door, the back portcullis, right, when you don't know. Right? Or maybe not even knowing that back portcullis was there. So the first step is always figuring out where these things are at. And that's really what host-based firewalls, you have to go through and figure it out, or you will figure it out real quick, right, when you turn them on and you've blocked different things. Same with on the servers. So maybe even more so on the server side. Right? Same question, same organizations. Nope, we don't know what all of our servers are listening for. Really? How can you not honestly know what your servers are doing in your environment? Is it an effort for you to go and actually do it? Absolutely, right? No one's saying that it's a trivial exercise. But at the same time, if you don't go through and do those kind of things, you've got Target, right? Because if you look at all the telemetry from Target, they had no clue what was going on in their network. They had no clue what was coming off of those POS systems. They just didn't. They didn't do their homework. If they would have sat and actually turned on the FireArm security stuff that they had purchased, where they would actually sat down and looked at some network traces, they would have figured out something bad was going on. And I think that's ultimately how things got discovered, right? Aside from credit cards being stolen, et cetera. So not a good slide, Kent? So the OS mitigation, right? So antivirus, like I said, can only go so far. Antivirus is all about doing that blacklist. We still have our gray list. We still have the white list we don't care about, but the gray list we do care about. So what can we do in the meantime? So lots of words over there. Go back and download slides. Don't try to read them now. Some of them don't even necessarily are necessarily obvious. But Emmet is a tool from Microsoft, the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, I remembered. And it is something that you can layer on top of Windows. And what it does is it hooks into different applications and enables these different mitigations at an application layer and selectively. So some of these things, so ASLR, It's on there somewhere, and it's about address space randomization. So loading applications in different places in address space so that the malicious code can't attack at the same location all the time. Real technical, low-level developer type stuff. You don't necessarily have to know about it. But if you turn that on for a lot of applications, you might blue screen your whole system. So you don't want to just turn it on for everything in your environment. However, turning that on for things like Java, it's a really good thing to do. For Firefox, for IE, for any of the browsers, right? It's a great thing to do. And that's what Emmet allows you to do. So there's all this host of mitigation techniques that the hackers take advantage of within Windows, right? They don't have to predict what those things are going to attack necessarily, but they can mitigate how those things commonly attack your enterprise. Another one of those awesome things, it just sits, it's a layer that doesn't pipe up. And I'll actually show you that. I think I have that on my host PC. There we go. It just sits as a nice little icon here in the taskbar. It requires elevation. Takes a second or so to come up. Pretty unobtrusive. There's an XML file for this. So kind of like PowerShell, if you don't know XML, you haven't at least done a little bit of XML and are familiar or comfortable with it, get used to it. It's in everything. So you can create XML configuration files to actually configure Emmet. It comes with three XML configuration files. One is called popular software. It includes, and so if we go down the list here, if I click on my apps button, these are all the ones that are actually enabled by default. Java is in here, Chrome is in here, Acrobat is in here. These are all things that they've explicitly tested. Now, that doesn't guarantee that they're always going to work. Like I said, sometimes putting one of these mitigations in place is going to break something. So you have to go and do your due diligence and test those kind of things. The cool part about Emmet, it's just an MSI. So if we go back to my Config Manager instance, where are you? There you are. And I minimize you. And we go to my packages. Actually, it may not be a, well, that's the configuration. So it is an application. So I go up here to my applications, Microsoft. Just an MSI. We import it in just like any other MSI. I have no idea where it is in that list. Maybe it's up. Maybe it's down. Where are you? Emmet 5.1, right? So imports in. They do come out with new versions. So within the past year and a half, they've gone from, I think, 4.0 all the way up to 5.1. It's not perfect. You're going to find articles out there that say people can get past it. Like most of those articles out there from security researchers, they've already cracked the local admin privileges in some way, right? And that's why we keep coming back to that one. If you can get local admin on a box, it's game over. It doesn't matter what else you have in place. So this is really about keeping the bad guys out that don't already have access. So what I had in here in the packages, though, was just that XML file. There we go, popular software. So I mentioned that before. That's one that comes with it. It includes the mitigations for Chrome, for Java, for all those normal ones. I think iTunes is even in there, right? All those normal ones that are commonly attacked in most environments and that are known to have, you know, long-running histories of being exploited. Push that out. It's very unobtrusive. I've done this for multiple organizations. Obviously, I have it on my PC. I push it out to my daughter's PCs at home. They haven't complained at all, and they play Minecraft like crazy, right? So that's Java-based. And so they haven't had any performance issues. They don't have any other issues, right? This is essentially shims that sit at the OS layer. That's a very crude way of putting it, and I'm sure the developers would probably not appreciate that, but that's ultimately what they do to put these different types of mitigations in place. Very easy to do, super secure if you go out and read some of the paperwork out there. So the Australian Signals Directorate, they specifically mention Emmet in their stuff about this is one of the best ones that you can have out there for Windows. So, okay. So Emmet's like the enforcer. So that's the picture, right? If you all saw Dirty Harry, the enforcer. He's going to make those bad things go away, hopefully. So what's good? We already talked a little bit about baselines with my one baseline. And of course, antivirus. Antivirus is antivirus. It's a good thing. You almost can't get away with it nowadays. But like I said before, it's definitely not the only thing that you should have in your environment. You need to be thinking about all these other things. You know, there are some of the antivirus products out there. Skep's not necessarily one of them, although Skep does a lot of things, but some of them do more than just antivirus, right? So if we talk about some of the competitors, they're not just doing antivirus, anti-malware. They're doing some of these other types of things. So it's definitely something to research on whatever product you're using, on what other capabilities that it has, and to go configure those capabilities. So let's see here. There was configuration baseline. So there's one, a couple of other things to talk about there. That's a new icon. I just updated that, so I can never find it. Let me go actually over to my workstation. So we have Security Configuration Manager, SCM, right? So kind of one of those wonderful near acronym clashes. Another one of those reasons I hate using SCCM is because there are just entirely too many things that are close to it and too much confusion that can be caused. SCM is a free tool for Microsoft, right? You can download this. It has a SQL database on the back end of it that installs locally. And it is effectively a bunch of different baselines. So it comes with baselines, let's put it that way, better way to put it. It comes with baselines of recommended Microsoft settings for different security settings within Windows. So as you can see, it'll actually download these. When I started this up right before the demo, it popped up a box that there was a new baseline available. Right, so I think when I first installed it, there was a checkbox that says notify me when there are new baselines available. And so that's what it did for me today. I have no idea which one it was because I wasn't paying attention. But you can see we have Windows 8.1 that's in here. We have IE11 that's in here. A lot of different ones that are focused on different applications. So if we actually go in here and look at the IE11 one, we'll go look at the computer one. That was the user one. The interface on this is definitely a little bit hokey. It's a little bit weird. It takes a little bit to get used to. But at the end of the day, it provides all the information that we need. So these are all the different settings. So if you're familiar with all the different settings that are in group policy, this is effectively a lot of those organized in a little bit of a different way. But the nice thing about these baselines is first it tells you the default. So there's that default column that's right there. It tells you the Microsoft recommendation, and then it tells you what's actually configured in this specific baseline. So if you go create your own baseline, you can copy this one and edit to your heart's content. Now you can actually see what Microsoft recommend versus what's default and what you actually have configured. Great for the security guys, keeps them out of group policy, keeps them out of Config Manager, obviously, also. We can also click on any one of these, and it pops open, right? So this is where the interface gets really funky, but, and I'll zoom in there. Please don't read all of this. But it gives you a description. It also talks about the vulnerability, the impact. It gives you lots more information about this single setting. So if you're just going through group policy and doing these kind of things, you're going to probably have to go out to the web and do lots of other research on this and figure out exactly what the impact of this is. All of that is directly within this baseline, right? So we don't have to go anywhere else to figure out, should I do this? Should I not do this? What am I going to break if I do these kind of things, right? So security almost always breaks something. Right? Whenever you start locking things down, so be prepared for that. You have to test these kind of things. Now, in SCM, we can export it to Excel sheet if we want. We can export it to a group policy backup. Let me zoom in there. And we can also export to the desired configuration manager format. That's from Config Manager 2007. But Config Manager 2012 will also import that. So we can come in here and both put it as a group policy, and we can export it out so that Config Manager can directly import this in, and now we can enforce that baseline with Config Manager. So all those settings that maybe our security guy, you know, us as the Config Manager guy, maybe we're not wanting to take responsibility for setting all of these, or you know, it's not within our authority to do that. Great, we can still have someone else do that and give us that, and then we can implement it. We don't have to give them access to Config Manager to do those kind of things. Not absolutely every setting can be enforced by a baseline in Config Manager, but most of them can, right? So most of the times, things like just registry values, which is a vast majority of group policy, no problem. Baselines will do no problem. There are other baselines out there, though. There is CIS, the computer, I don't even remember what it stands for. It's a computer information security, computer internet security. Yeah, I think it's computer internet security. I don't know, I could have that wrong. But if you go look for CIS security, it's a clearinghouse for security baselines. Folks typically pay for these. You can go and download the guidance, but you can also download the baselines also. So there are lots of other folks. So going back to Don't invent this yourself, right? Don't think that you have to come up with these things yourself. Don't even think that you necessarily have to go through here and figure out these things yourself. There are lots of other folks on the web. Some of it's for pay. Some of it they're going to give you some free guidance. But they're going to give you the guidance that you need to make intelligent decisions about these things, right? You're not left out on your own on doing these kind of things. CIS also recommends Emmett, right? So if you start going to any of those security clearinghouses now, they're all recommending that you do Emmett, of course, and they're recommending these other things also. Okay, should I go back to the... Oh, there it is. Should I go back to that slide, Kent? Sorry, I got to pick on him. So great, there's some great baseline examples out there. This is SCCM Guru. I honestly don't even know whose page this is. So if you're this person, reach out to me because it'd be cool to have some dialogue offline. But these baselines that he has on his blog aren't specifically for security, but they do things like disable auto updates. Most of them are disabling auto updates in Java, in Flash, all those annoying ones that our users get pop-ups for. He has baselines out there that automatically turn those off so that now us as enterprise IT can actually control those kind of things. They're also great examples and great starters. So if you don't know where to start with a baseline, these are great places to start because the code's really tight, it's really small, it's all PowerShell. It's pretty easy to look at. So grab the deck. All the links are actually in there. Of course, there's links from Sherry in here also. So anybody that doesn't know Sherry, definitely get to know her blog at the very least. She's a wealth of information on this kind of stuff because she does it for a very large organization. I just demoed that. So one of the things in conclusion here really is it's not about being reactive, right? You have to be proactive. So that's one of the things that comes up on the forums every now and then. So Kent talked about ADRs earlier today, right? The automatic deployment rules for software updates. One of the questions that comes up a lot is, should I use the attribute required equals for my ADR filters? And while technically, in my opinion, there's nothing wrong with that, it's being reactive, right? You're waiting until someone tells you that you have a problem. You're not actually making that update available before someone asks for it, so that as soon as they ask for it, it's there. Security is not like that. You can't wait until, castle metaphor, till that wall fell to realize, oh, the enemy's at the gates, right? It doesn't work that way. You want to get to those folks before they even get close to the gates, before they get close to the wall. You can't sit back and wait for them to come to you. You definitely have to monitor and audit because sometimes you just don't know, right? Sometimes you have to be reactive. There's so many new things that happen all the time. But that's why you have to keep up with these different blogs. You have to keep up with the different security folks that are out there that are actually doing this on a day-to-day basis. Once again, you don't have to be the one that's figuring all these things out. But you do have to be the one that's implementing in your environment on a proactive basis. And make sure you're always adding resistance. Think about, how is this making the bad guy's job more difficult? Whatever it actually is. Now, at the end of the day, if you're making your users' lives more difficult, maybe that's a good thing, you know, to talk about in IT. We don't like so-and-so, and we, you know, had fun with them and locked down their account, et cetera. You know, maybe you have a scoreboard back in IT. But at the end of the day, right, IT is about enabling the business. So if we're making their jobs so that they can't get their jobs done, we've really failed. We've completely failed because there's no reason for us to be there at that point in time. Right? It's the old metaphor. What's the most secure computer? It's that computer that's off in the vault, you know, that's buried under concrete. That's great. It's super secure at that point in time. Totally unusable, though. So if what we've created and provided to the end users is unusable, doesn't matter, right? We have no reason for actually being there anymore. So you've always got to balance these two things, but you've always got to add resistance to what the bad guys are doing. So you got to keep ahead of the bad guys. It's not an easy thing to do. Monitoring, auditing. We can use a product. What's that product called that we do for auditing, monitoring, Cameron? I don't.
Collection
services? Yeah, but there's that monitoring one that's out there. There you go. So Cameron informs us there's a product called System Center Operations Manager that's great for it. So yep, absolutely, right? That's another thing that's not specifically putting resistance in there, but it's allowing us to see what's going on in our environment. If we're not looking, right, once again, castle metaphor, you've got sentries that are walking the wall. Why? They want to see who's in that tree line over there. You've got to be looking out. You can't be just looking down. Looking down is a good thing on occasion to make sure that there's not someone who snuck up on us. But you've got to be looking out. You've got to be thinking about all those things that can happen to you. And then the bottom things, right? Don't limit yourself. Don't limit yourself to just antivirus. Don't limit yourself to just this, finances data, right? There are lots of ways to get into different networks. Once again, Sony, Target, Jimmy John's, Chase. I'm sure there's some other ones I can't think of offhand, right? We're going to continue to hear about these. Brad was talking about that this morning, right, with the EMS stuff. That's not the end of it. And those are just the public ones, right? How many of you doubt that there's a lot more private ones out there that just have not been disclosed whatsoever? There's got to be tons and tons of other ones out there, right? And there are. We all know that. So you've got to make sure that you're looking at all the different aspects, that you're considering them every day in your admin duties, that what am I doing today? Am I enabling a hacker, or am I adding resistance to what that hacker or those bad guys are ultimately doing? Resistance, resistance, resistance. So I'm not a security guy by trade necessarily, and I've said that, right? You guys don't have to invent it. There are lots of really smart security folks out there. If you go to Channel 9 and you search for any of these folks, right? So I'm going to say it just because I'm going to try to say it. So we have Paula. Anyone know how to say it? Johan? Yeah, exactly. You know, I actually think I kind of had it the other day, but I don't even know. Yanis, yeah. And there's Hussein, right? So you loosely work with Hussein, right? And of course, Marcus. Marcus is a great guy. Erdal, you guys have had Erdal at the user group up there in Denmark, right, Kent? Erdal's awesome. So, you know, Erdal's actually a certified, a certified white hat hacker, right? So he's very smart. He knows what the hackers are actually doing. Kevin Mitnick. Everyone know who Kevin Mitnick is. He is effectively the legend in hackers, right? Kevin Mitnick, super smart. And he thinks about these things at different angles, right? He's not always thinking technical. Technical's a piece of it. He owns a pen testing company now. He flies all over the world, gives talks and things like that. But he's thinking about the social engineering. He's the original social engineer, at least publicly, right? That's a huge and easy way to get into, you know, the fortress, is you just bribe that guard. You know, the heck with trying to go through, you know, the 30 guys with pikes up there. I'm just going to bribe the guy in the back. And those are the kind of things that he does. So keeping up with things that he says and the way he thinks about them, because like I said, he thinks about things differently. It's a great thing to do. He's got a Twitter feed. Sometimes there's really good stuff. Sometimes there's interesting other stuff. But he always has something interesting to say. The last guy, Aaron Margosis, he's actually a Microsoft guy. He co-authored the last system internals books with Mark Rusinovich. So if Mark is going to bring him under his wing, you know Aaron's super smart. The CIS security baselines that I talked about before, Aaron's also a co-author on those, right? So lots of people out there, follow their blogs, follow their Twitter feeds, once again, going back to the whole Twitter thing, and they're going to give you awesome ideas on both what the hackers are actually doing and how to add resistance in your network so that you're not, you know, forced into that resume generating event when the data gets stolen. And that's enterprise security with Config Manager.